Vein really running right through the scriptures, the whole area of how we deal with our resources, not just our money, but also our time and our gifts, our talents, the things that we can do for each other. But primarily in this time of fundraising, we're going to be mainly looking at money. There's a story of a farmer who visited the church, and he spoke to the receptionist, and he said, is the head hog of the trough around? And the receptionist looked really shocked. The head hog of the trough? She said, are you talking about our beloved minister? She said, do you mean our dear parson, our one who shepherds us? He said, oh, all right then, whatever. He said, it's just that I've just sold a few sows and I was going to donate £10,000 to the church. Ah, she said. Well, in that case, she said, I think I can see the little porker just coming down the corridor. We have a really strange attitude to money, don't we? We have a very odd perception of what it's all about. It's funny stuff, touches our character. It's a very sensitive subject. We are so, you're not all British in this room, I know that, but certainly from a British perspective, we've got a real problem over our attitude about finances, about money. British culture is a very, very strange thing. I'm a great fan of Bill Bryson, and in his book Notes from a Small Island, he laughs a little bit about the British attitude to money. He said, in my part of America, he said, if you meet a stranger on the train, the best way to get to know them is sit opposite and say, so, how much did you make this year? And the conversation's away, and the friendship starts. You would never get that on the train from Woking to Clapham Junction, would you? It's not going to happen. It's not British. It's not personal. It's not private. Yet, us Brits, we are hugely conscious of the badge we have on our cars, and we want people to know it when we do well. In a kind of indirect sort of way, we want to show it off. If we make a lot, we want people to see. So it's all kind of back to front and upside down, and really quite crazy. What is odd about money is, you know, we long to have it, don't we? We long to have money, and as soon as we get it, we give it away again. We do something with it, we get rid of it. Very, very strange thing to do. And do you know, money has actually money in itself has absolutely no value. It's got no value at all. The only value that money has is in the transaction that you make with that money. So as we save our pennies and as we set up our different savings accounts and the different ways that we hoard our cash, it actually has no value at all. It's kind of pending, isn't it? It's pending, awaiting some kind of transaction in the hope that there's no credit crunch and all these funny numbers on a computer disappear into the ether and it's all gone. It has no value at all, only in the thing that we do with it. For example, this £10 note, it could be used... crumpled old note in my back pocket. It could be used for something really righteous, or it could be used for something really frivolous, couldn't it? I mean, it could be used for any number of things. It could be used for something holy, or it could be used for something evil. You know, I could use this money to help arm a nation that's going to go and destroy another nation. Or I could use this money to help a charity that wants to go and feed a famine-struck land. It can be used for good, or it can be used for evil as something very bland, something very nothing about it. And if I use it for evil purposes, it actually has a negative value, because I would be richer if I didn't have it, if that were the case. So it's a very, very strange thing. It's a very strange thing. It's only a piece of paper, yet it has the power to bless or destroy. Not because of what it is so much as money, but because of what it represents. What does this represent in my back pocket? What does it represent? Anybody want to shout something out? What does this represent? Where is its identity? Where is its force, its power, its ability to do something for good or bad? Pardon? Say again. Pay tax bill, yeah, but where is its identity? That's what you can do with it, Ian. That's right. But where is its identity? Its identity is in me, because I am the holder of it. It's in my back pocket. It's mine. £10. It's my £10. Basically, it's an extension of itself. So it has no value in itself per se. It's an extension of me. Does anybody want this? She's what?
She's done this before.
This is Helen's father-in-law. He says she's done this before.
Oh.
It's yours.
Oh, bless you, thanks.
No. No, it's yours now, Helen. You're responsible for it. That money has just changed character. Because when it was in my pocket, it represented me. It represented everything that I would do with it, everything that I would long to see happen to it. It's now representing Helen, which is a little bit of a cause for concern. But apart from that, it's suddenly taken on Helen's identity because she's going to do something else with it. The value of that money is not in the picture of the Queen and the watermark. The value of that money is in Helen's heart. As the value of all that we have, every single one of us is in our hearts. That's where its value is. So, biblically, in terms of the whole area of giving, the whole area of what we have to use for the purposes of the kingdom, basically, we are not interested in money. We're interested in hearts. We're interested not in the amounts of money in worldly terms. What we're interested in is something else. Yeah, there are figures banded around. We've got to raise an awful lot of money in order to fulfill our building scheme, which is really important to us, in order to engage in mission in the town, in order to help those in other countries who are struggling. There are sums to be raised, and the calculator gives us numbers, but they're only numbers. Where the real power lies is in our own hearts. The widow's mite in Mark 12 and the feeding of the 5,000 in Matthew 14 are stories which express how the value of money is turned upside down in biblical terms. It's completely turned on its head. The value of the widow's mite, it was a fortune in heavenly terms. An absolute fortune. Why? Because it was all that she had. The little boy's packed lunch, the loaves and the fishes. That was a fantastic amount. Look what it did. There were 12 basket loads left over. It is an incredible thing. I want to just read to us from the prophet Malachi. Malachi is the last book of the Old Testament. I'm going to read to you from chapter 3, verses 6 to 12. Malachi is trying to bring people back into the way of the Lord. And I'll say something about it in a moment. This passage in my NIV, New International Version, is actually headed up. You know how some Bibles have little headings over the themes? It's actually headed up Robbing God, which I always look at and I think, whoa, that's quite a strong title and rather a challenging one. But Malachi says this as he prophesies the words of the Lord. I, the Lord, do not change. So you, O descendants of Jacob, are not destroyed. Ever since the time of your forefathers, you have turned away from my decrees and have not kept them. Return to me, and I will return to you, says the Lord Almighty. But you ask, how are we to return? Will a man rob God? Yet you rob me. But you ask, how do we rob you, Lord? In tithes and in offerings. You are under a curse, the whole nation of you, because you are robbing me. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Test me in this, says the Lord Almighty, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that you will not have room enough for it. I will prevent pests from devouring your crops, and the vines in your fields will not cast their fruit, says the Lord Almighty. And then all the nations will call you blessed, for yours will be a delightful land, says the Lord Almighty. Malachi lived a few years after the return of the Israelites from exile in Babylon. You're looking around 500 years before Jesus was born. And it was a time when Cyrus the Persian king, had given permission for the Israelites to go back to Jerusalem, about a 1,000-mile journey west. And Cyrus was... Have any of you seen the film 300 with Gerard Butler? Yeah? Anybody seen 300 with Gerard Butler? Xerxes the king. Well, Hollywood got hold of that, but in real life, Xerxes is Cyrus's grandson. So Cyrus, Xerxes' his father was Darius, and Darius' father was Cyrus. And it was Cyrus who gave Nehemiah. Nehemiah is one of my great heroes in the scriptures. He's an engineer, and he's a leader, and he's a fearless man. And he goes first. Cyrus gives permission for him to go back to the broken down Jerusalem first to rebuild all the walls. And Malachi comes a little bit later, not very much, just a very few years. The walls are built, the temple's built. But what has happened is that the Israelites have gone back into a way of really ineffective religion. They are not, in Old Testament terms, big, big sinners. Before the exile, they practiced child sacrifice. They took idols into the temple, which were abhorrent to the Lord. They'd kind of got over all of that stuff. But they were lukewarm, really, in their religion. They had rebuilt this temple expecting the supernatural power of God just to come and fill it. And they had really gone off the boil. And it had come to the point after a few years where they really just began to think that God didn't really love them. God was not blessing them. He was not providing for them. It brought no reward to go through and go through all the rituals and serve him. And things were in a bad way. They had lost contact with God, with the God that their religion was all about. And if you transpose that into a modern day example, they had just become churchgoers who tick the boxes because that's what you're supposed to do. And God was not pleased. They had lost contact, they had lost relationship with the God who loved them so much, with the one that religion was all about. At Alpha last week. How many of you are on Alpha? Yep, fair few. There's about 40 of us meeting every week for Alpha. We're meeting this afternoon. And on Alpha last week in my little group, we challenged each other to take up a fairly recent app from Nikki Gumbel, a Bible app, which is Read the Bible in a Year. which is several passages, usually a psalm, an Old Testament and a New Testament reading and a commentary with it. And so I'm just a week into that. And ploughing through Leviticus at the moment, which is a little bit like stirring concrete after it's set. Really, really hard work. Really, really not very inspiring. The Levites, they were the priestly race. And the Levites, and it's the laws for the priests. And I think, oh, blimey, not more. But I've persevered with it. And even after just 7 days of a fairly long passage of Leviticus every day, do you know what it's begun to dawn on me? It started to filter through my thick skull, the emphasis on the need for perfect giving. The emphasis for the need that the lamb, that the goat, that the ox be a perfect animal. And that is the only thing that is acceptable in the law as it is brought for sacrifice on the altar as an atonement for sin. And Malachi, elsewhere in the passage, is furious with the Israelites because they're getting around this by not giving the best. Bringing a perfect lamb or a goat or whatever, or an ox, or a pair of doves if you haven't got much money, or if you're really, really destitute, some grain is expensive. It's really, really costly. And Mike is furious because what people have started doing is bringing imperfect animals, blind animals, sick animals, dying animals, oxes that can no longer pull the plow, so they're no good to me anyway, so I'll go and sacrifice them to the Lord and I'll get away with that as a gift. And Mike says, no, you will not, because God is absolutely not having that. And it's dawned on me through reading this very stodgy book that we all of us avoid because we don't like the Old Testament very much. We prefer the New. Just how fantastically important the Old Testament is. Unless we get a head around the mind of the people of the Old Testament, we can't really fully understand just exactly what Jesus did for us. The nature of the need for perfect giving was so profound that when Jesus comes and gives of himself as the perfect sacrifice, the imagery and the relevance of it is profoundly powerful. But if we don't understand the Old Testament, it doesn't mean anything. But Mike is making really, really clear that the people are bringing inappropriate gifts. We know from the gospel, and this is what is so amazing, that of course in the end Jesus comes and sacrifices himself as the perfect lamb in order that we don't have to do that stuff anymore. We don't have to go off into some farm or around Surrey and buy animals and, I don't know, kill them up here on the platform. It's dreadfully messy. We don't do that anymore. We don't have to do it because Jesus has done it for all of us. He's paid the price with himself. Absolutely, utterly, 100% supremely perfect. And it never has to be done again. But this idea that our giving is a costly thing is profound, and it's such a challenge to us. Mother Teresa said, if you only give what you don't need, it's not actually giving. It's not giving at all. There's a story of an ambitious young man who told his minister that he was in his early years and he wanted to tithe his income. And at that point, he was earning just about £40 a week. And so he was giving £4 a week as a tithe. And the years went by and he became fantastically successful and incredibly wealthy over the years. Until in the end, his tithe amounted to £500 a week, 2,000 quid a month, just in tithe. So he made an appointment with the minister, and he goes along to the minister, and he says, excuse me, he said, do you think it would be possible for me to reduce this tithe? I really can't afford this. This is an awful lot of money. And the minister said to him, well, I'm not sure what we can do about that, but what we can do is pray that your gross income goes back to £40 a week, because then you'll be able to afford the £4. And if there was ever a story that proves that the whole issue of numbers when it comes to money is just an absolute mirage, that's it. And the old adage that the more we have, the less we have, is also incredibly true. It is far, 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 far harder for those of us who are wealthy to give than for those who have very, very little. It is very, very difficult. It is a huge challenge for the wealthy to be generous. It's been the same through history. It was the same today, and it always will be. It's just the way it is. In Malachi's day, it was a costly business to bring a perfect lamb or a great ox. You can't pull a plow without an ox. Big deal. Very big deal. And through this, we learn that nobody has any more power than anybody else when it comes to giving. And it's one of the most important principles when it comes to our faith. Every single person on the planet has exactly the same amount of giving power as every other person on the planet. Whether it's the widow with the mite, whether it's the pauper with a half a penny, or whether it's Donald Trump. I don't suppose he'll give a lot, but never mind. He might. Whoever it is. A widow with nothing has as much money as Bill Gates. It's nothing to do with numbers. Nothing at all. And so Malachi uses the language of robbing God, which is really, really strong stuff. But, you know, just to bring this to interland, really, because we need to get on with communion. But just to say, there's a blessing attached to this, which is just so, so wonderful. Because God says, "See if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing on you that you will not have enough room for it." We don't give in order to get back from God. That's prosperity ministry. We're not into that stuff. We don't give in order to make a profit. But the biblical imperative is true. When we give sacrificially, God looks after us. Liz and I made a decision when we were long, long ago, and we've been married 30 years, so it was just after we were married. It was a hard thing to do because we really didn't have anything very much at all. But we made a decision to tithe on our gross income. So we would tithe before the tax man got a hold of anything. And Liz took a while to persuade me. I wasn't too sure about this because I wanted to save up for a car. And that seemed rather important to me. But Liz has always been a step ahead in these things, and still is, by the way. And we did it. And ever since we started, God has looked after us. And as Luke 6 says, you know, do not judge and you will not be judged. Do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven. Give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure that you use, it will be measured to you. The way that we behave is the way it will be measured to us. And absolutely true. God has blessed us so much. Sometimes we've just not had enough to put groceries on the table in the years past when the children were little. Things are different now. But we always ended up with far more than we gave. Somehow it would come through the letterbox, or a check would come in the post, or something would happen. And it would often be tenfold, twentyfold what we had struggled to give. Not because we gave because we wanted it back, but we know that God watches us and is with us every moment of the day. Isn't that amazing? And Micah is saying, really, what a fantastic thing it is to give of our best. The great principle for us in our giving is that we don't give what's left. It is a challenge, it's not easy, and it's something we all need to sort of work through. Not just to do with building schemes, but to do with general giving and feeding the poor and building the kingdom and looking after each other. But the Bible is so, so clear that we're called to give first. We don't give what's left. We give first, and then we live on what's left. And that's really quite a hard thing to do. But there's a challenge for you. We'll look at the whole subject of finance right between the eyes. We're going to be very un-British about this over the next few months. And I just ask you to commit to prayer. Your own wealth, your own bank accounts, your own wallets and purses, and just think, how can we invest this in the kingdom in an eternal way? You won't get anything back from the banks. They won't give you any interest these days. But just imagine investing in the kingdom, massive returns in the eternal plan of things. We serve an awesome God, an amazing God, a wonderful God. And on the back of this sermon, can I just get the band out? We're going to sing. Oh, it's just you. Okay. Don and Helen are going to lead us in a song. Then we're going to share communion together before we close with another couple of songs. You may have noticed we've not taken an offering today. We're not going to. But there is a plate in the porch, and there's one on that chair over there by the door. And really, what we want to say to you is, we don't want to bring the plate to you. We want you to go to the plate. Has a rather different feel to it, because it means we have to think about whether we want to make the journey, actually go to the effort and think about it, to actually go to the plate and put in our offering. So we're not going to bring the plate to you. When it comes to it, your gifts, if you feel able, will be greatly received. But your giving is between you and God. It's nobody else's business. It's nothing to do with us. Nothing to do with anybody. It's just about your heart and your relationship with God. Never mind your neighbor. Never mind what other people are doing. No one's business. It's between you and him. What we do in secret, the Lord sees. Let's stand and sing.
Christ alone, my hope is found. He is my life, my strength, my song. This cornerstone, this solid ground, firm in the fiercest drought and storm. What heights of love, what depths of peace, when fears are stilled, when striving cease, my comforter.